The title of the sermon is Fire and Salt. I was going to actually name it Salt and Catch Fire, but I'm betting nobody in this congregation would know what I'm talking about, right? I didn't think so. Okay, that's why I didn't. It's a TV show, but it's a geek show. You guys wouldn't know this one. All right, but this is a sermon about Elisha that actually kind of spawned the series. And what happened was Victoria came into my room, and I'm working, and she does this a lot. She goes, I have a biblical question, and okay. And usually these biblical questions I don't have answers to because she's reading some area of the Bible I haven't even studied yet. And this was one of those times she came in and she said, I got to talk to you about this Elisha thing and the bears. And so I knew what she was talking about, but I'd never done a formal study on it. And so when she was all done, I gave her my typical theological answer, which is I really don't know. I'll have to do a study on that. I really have no idea. But it is a very bizarre story. How many of you have heard that story, that the little cartoon show? Do you remember from Sesco? Any of you? No? There's actually an expression, I don't know if you've ever heard this, called an Elisha bear. Have you ever heard of an Elisha bear? Elisha bear is a bear that kills a human. It's to this day, they'll sometimes refer to them as an Elisha bear. Not as much now, but now that we're a post-Christian nation, apparently, we don't use the biblical stuff. But there is an expression called Elisha bear. It's a bear that kills a human. And we're going to get to that, but I'm going to start. Now, I had a tendency to want to skip over a lot of this, but I thought I'm going to go hit all these points because what happens in the next sequence of stories, which are very brief in 2 Kings, is we see a transformation take place in Elisha. And I want to show that transformation, and this has gone through three different little vignettes, little stories. And I know, and I'm going to actually kind of jump over and then jump back to one. I know that gets confusing. And so I thought, I need a way that we can track which story we're on. And I remember when I was a kid, there was a show on that used to do this very well called Scooby-Doo. So I'm going to use Scooby-Doo terminology here for you. The first thing is the case of the disbelieving prophets. And so we're going to pick up 2 Kings right where we left off. Now, remember last week, Elijah leave. By the way, Victoria and I looked up the actual Hebraic pronunciation of Elisha, because I thought, I need to come with some other way, because Elisha is too hard, you know, and it's Elisha, and I thought, no, I'm just going to go with Elisha. So so Elisha, fortunately, you know, Elijah's leaving, so we won't have so much confusion coming up. But last week, we saw Elijah leave, and he left in a very dramatic fashion, which is, I think, God's just smiling on Elijah, because Elijah was a very dramatic man, you know. So God says, okay, he needs to leave in a dramatic way. A chariot of fire comes in to separate Elisha from Elijah, and then a whirlwind takes Elijah up into heaven, and one of the only two people in the Bible who don't die. And so that's what happens. And then the next story is a little bit interesting, I found. It comes back. So he's walking back. He comes back through the Jordan again. And when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho opposite him saw him, they said, look, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha, which is nice, but it's actually the spirit of the Lord that's resting on Elisha, just so we're clear on that. And they came to meet him and bowed themselves to the ground before him and said, behold now, there are with your servants 50 strong men. Please let them go and search for your master. Perhaps the Spirit of the Lord has taken him up and cast him on some mountain or in some valley. This to me is just a hilarious, hilarious picture. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this just for a second. Because the Bible, especially 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, the author of the Kings, the whole purpose of the book is to show you the spiritual connection of the physical kings. So the spiritual world as it intersects with the lives of the kings. There is a book that keeps getting referred to that hasn't been found, the Chronicles of the Kings. And they'll say, well, haven't all these deeds been written in the Chronicles of the Kings? And we don't have that book. So it's a kind of a shame we don't have that book. But the purpose of the book of 1 and 2 Kings was to show the spiritual connection. And so it kind of focuses a lot on the spiritual stuff. And where there isn't spiritual things, it kind of glosses over some really good points of the story. But I think as I read this, there's a very clear picture that comes out. And that is the prophets do not believe Elijah. Because this is a pretty fantastical story, you have to admit. It's never happened before in all of history. They saw them all go across the river. They saw them disappear in the distance. And Elisha comes back telling this story. And he's shaken up. Remember, he saw him go. He was at first in awe, and then he wept because he lost one of his mentor and his best friend. And so he comes back, he's all kind of haggard and worn, and I go, Elisha, are you okay? Are you okay? Here, sit down, get him a drink, and all these guys sitting around, what happened? Well, we walked up there, yeah, and then a fiery chariot appeared. A fiery chariot, you say? Oh, okay, And then a whirlwind took him all the way up into heaven, and his body's gone. And you can see him kind of looking around each other going, whirlwind, okay. Hey, Elisha, just spitballing here, got this idea. I got 50 people sitting here doing nothing. Why don't we see if they can find the body of Elijah? Why just, just in case maybe he fell out of the whirlwind, is lying on a body somewhere. Why don't we go try to find this body that disappeared in heaven, make sure there are no signs of struggle or whatever. Just kind of see what's going on. Why don't we go do that? And Elijah tells them, you don't need to do that because I know what I saw and there's no body. He says, you shall not send. Don't do that. But they kept going on him until finally he got actually ashamed that he wouldn't let them. They kept pressing him and they said, we need to do this. He said, okay, go ahead. And so then they went out and they searched for 3 days, 50 men combing this area that Elijah told them they won't find him, looking for a body, and they don't find it. And they come back to Elijah now and like, you know what, Elijah? We searched for 3 days and we didn't find a body. And Elijah's kind of all like,
I'm as stupid does.
I kind of told you weren't going to find him. I don't know why you had to go. And in fact, he actually tells them, did I not tell you? Don't go. This is like a great time for the prophet to say, I told you so. So I really believe at this point, they're kind of coming to the realization there are supernatural things happening in Elisha's life that we've never seen. And people get scared of that. And if God is working in your life in a way that seems almost supernatural or completely supernatural, and we call it spiritual. We have supernatural, natural. God just has natural, so it doesn't matter to him. But if that's happening, you're trying to explain. Ever try to explain to people, and they're looking at you like you're crazy? I mean, really? Sometimes, I just know God's going to do this, and then he does that, and they'll go, you're crazy. Just sometimes people don't believe it. And I think what's really telling about this story is two things. First of all, Elijah did let them go. I think a year, 2 years later, Elijah would have said, no, you just put an end to it. But he's still kind of becoming the main prophet of God. He's not quite there yet. We'll see by the end of this story, by the end of this chapter, he will be. But he's not quite there yet. And so he said, okay, go. But they come back, and I think what's really interesting is Elijah does not offer to go with them. He could. I'll walk you right to the place where he left. You can count the footsteps. Two sets of footsteps went in. One footsteps came out. We could show this to you. But he doesn't. That's because you don't need to constantly check what you already know to be true. And sometimes I think we need to learn this lesson with God. How many times you ask God, if you love me, God, you will. Or some version of that prayer, right? I really need you to prove it one more time, God. One more time. We should know certain things by now. And we should know God loves us. And we shouldn't have to ask him to prove it all the time. And so Elijah, the one thing he did exactly right was, you guys go. I'm sitting here. I'm resting. Because you're going to find nothing. I know what's true. And so they went and they came back. Says, you're absolutely right. So that moves us on now to the case of the cursed city. This is the next little vignette. Because while he's there and then the prophets come back, the men of Jericho come forward. And they said, look, we live in this wonderful city. It's pleasant. But the water is bad, and we can't seem to grow anything here. That's kind of a big thing about a city, right? It's a wonderful city. Don't drink the water. Can't grow anything. Other than that, it's just great here. Where did this curse come from? And it's a curse, by the way. It's a curse on the land of Jericho. Well, if you remember back when we started this series, we talked about the curse of Jericho. But to show you that, I got to jump all the way back to a series we did last year called The Champions, when Joshua takes the city of Jericho to begin with. This is the first move into the Promised Land. the very first city they take, Joshua tells the people, the Lord has given you the city. The city shall be under a ban, though, and all its belongings. Keep yourselves from everything under the ban. Meaning, usually when you sack a city, you take plunder. You're taking no plunder. Anything that you see that you covet, forget it. Just forget it. You can't have anything under the ban. Nothing. Except the gold and the silver and the bronze and the iron. Those you will bring and we will give it to the Lord. It's like, oh, wow, God, he gets everything. You know, wow, that's kind of a... By the way, this is the only city they get that instruction to. Every other city they take the plunder and divide it amongst themselves. But not Jericho. Why? Because it's the first city and the first fruits go to the Lord. So what he said was, when you take this city, which by the way was an impossible take, it is the first city, therefore everything from it comes to me. And after that, everything goes to you. So they conquer many cities after that, and they take everything. Okay, when it's all done, when they have the battle, and they're standing near the rubble, here's what Joshua says. He makes them all take an oath. And it says, cursed before the Lord is anyone who rises up and builds the city. We talked about this because they rebuild the city in Elijah's day, right? If it happens, here's what's going to happen. He's going to lose his firstborn and his lastborn. Although some people actually believe the translation is all kids. But the firstborn and lastborn are going to die if you try to do this. So a man did it. He rebuilt the city of Jericho, but he lost his firstborn and his lastborn. That was in the very first part that we read about Elijah's. You know, right before Elijah bursts on the scene, that happens. So now they've built this wonderful city. It's a great spot. It's right on the Jordan River. It's a wonderful spot. People move back to it naturally, and they move back to it, but the water is undrinkable. And they can't get any crops to grow in the field. This place is under a curse. And so they're coming to Elisha, and I find that interesting. They never went to Elijah. Because I think they did go to Elijah, and Elijah said, so what? Why are you living in a cursed city? Leave. You know, don't tell me about this. But they come to Elisha now, because he's the new sheriff's in town. Maybe he'll be a little different. And by the way, Elisha is different, because they're both symbolic of different parts of God. Elijah brings judgment, Elisha brings grace, and we see both of those in God. And so Elisha is a different prophet. He really is. And so when they come to him, they explain the situation. I'm sure he consults the Lord, and then he comes and he does something really, really bizarre. He says, bring me a new jar and put salt in it. So they brought him a new jar full of salt. And he went out to the spring of water and threw salt into it. Now let me just tell you, if impure water is your problem, typically salt is not your solution. You know, have you ever drunk salt water? So he takes salt, he throws it in the water. He's like, this is like, thanks a lot. You know, before it was a little bit bad, now it's salty and bad. And so he says, thus says the Lord, I have purified these waters. There shall not be from their death or unfruitfulness any longer. And guess what? It was true. So the waters have been purified to this day, according to the word of Elijah, which he spoke. Now, I'm going to come back to this one, because this one is really interesting to me. Why? But before that, let me move on to the thing that kind of started everything, the case of the bald man's curse. So this is the story as it reads in most Bibles. He went up from there. After he does all this, he goes up to Bethel. That's an important point. And he was going up. Young children came out from the city and mocked him and said, go up, you bald head. Go up, you bald head. Now, I'm looking around the audience here, and I know that some of you probably heard young children saying that to you, but I just want to caution you, don't pray for bears. That's really not I think, what we should take away from here. And so when he looks behind him and saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and tore up 42 of their number, and then he went on from there to Mount Carmel, and then eventually ends up back in Samaria. What a bizarre story, you know. So Elijah called fire down on somebody once and killed them, actually a couple times. And Elisha, now he doesn't actually call for the bear, he just curses them. You know, we don't know what the curse was, but he curses them in the name of the Lord. He wasn't just swearing at them, you know, get away you blank, blank, blank kids. That wasn't the curse. He was cursing them in the name of the Lord. And so, you know, it is a bizarre story. And I thought, wow, there must be something we're missing here. If it's okay by God that 42 children get eaten by a bear, you're not only okay by God, but he actually does the eating part. So I'm like, what is the deal there? So I went back, and first thing I do is I kind of look at the words that are there that get translated the way they got translated. And I thought, well, that was interesting because it's really not the common translation for those words. This young actually gets usually translated young or insignificant. Like, don't really matter much. But that lads or children actually gets translated youths or servants. So a new picture kind of emerges from there when we talk about insignificant servants, doesn't it? Or even lads. Lads, I mean, that's a word we don't use very much today, lads, but it actually means young man. So these were not kids that would be in the lookout, or even children who'd be in the loft. That would be somewhere around the 20-year-old. There were 50 of them. So I want you to start getting a new picture, because the bears killed 42. There are 50 of them. So there are 50 young men around age 19 or 20, and they come out to mock him. That's different. That's not a group of kids. That's a gang, right? And so I thought, well, what are 50 guys doing hanging around this spot on the road to see Elijah walk by? Well, you have to understand that in those days, Israel was split into two kingdoms. We have Judah in the south, and we have Israel in the north. Now, most of the story here is going to take place up in Israel, because the king we're talking about had his place in Shechem. He was Jeroboam. So Jeroboam was the king there, and Jeroboam did something very interesting at Bethel for a very interesting reason. By the way, Jeroboam had the opportunity to unite the kingdom, but he got some bad advice from the boys he rolled with, a lot of young people running the kingdom, and he ended up creating a split instead. He was really positioned to become the king of all of Israel, and he couldn't come to terms with the people. So they ended up splitting, and then he became very afraid because clearly people pulled away and he couldn't stop them. What's going to happen if more people pulls away? Before very long, I'm going to be king of nothing. And so in his heart, he says, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. That's who's in the other place. And so if the people go there to offer sacrifices in Jerusalem, so he's worried if the people start their pilgrimage to offer their sacrifices at the high places a few times a year, they're going to say, you know what, if we're coming here for our sacrifices, this is where a king should be. And I'm going to lose my people. And the heart of the people return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, which is the descendant of David that rules over there, and they'll kill me. And so that was always, you know, the end result there. So he decides he has to do something. He talks to his boys, and they come up with this idea. So he makes two golden calves, that's Baal, and he said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set one of them in a temple in Bethel, and the other one he set in a temple in Dan. And then this, of course, became a great sin, for the people went to worship before the idol, and he made houses on the high places and made priests from among all the people, and he did not pick sons of Levi, which is against the law. So he basically created his own religion. He says, this is your God. Don't bother traveling all the way to Jerusalem. You know, don't do that. It's like, you know, someone's like, oh, you live all the way over in White Oak. I'm going to set up a church that worships calves. Don't go all the way to Spirit Chapel. You know, oh, yeah, right, I'll pull in here. It's just like, it worked. That was the amazing thing. It actually worked. They actually got the people to go there and worship. So you have to understand, these were not small children. They were acolytes in the Temple of Baal. Now, here's something else that you kind of have to get a picture of, is that the acolytes and priests in Baal were very afraid of Elijah. And not without cause, by the way. He kills like 900 of them in a day. So they're not ready to challenge Elijah. That happened once. It didn't turn out well for the priests and priestesses and acolytes of Baal, you may remember. They killed them. And so they're a little afraid of Elijah, but word has spread. Elijah's gone. And so now these guys are feeling a little full of themselves. And I like the idea that they're insignificant young men in the temple. So they're like acolytes. They're the ones cleaning latrines and sweeping up after the priest. You try to work your way up. Eventually, someday, you'll be an assistant priest and then a priest, you know, and then you get the cushy job. But at the beginning, you have to work. You know, you have to work as all the dirty jobs. And they see Elijah walking up, and they realize Elijah is no longer with him. And he's nobody. Right, Elijah, okay, everybody's afraid of him. He calls fire from heaven. But Elijah, at this point, hadn't done anything, you know. And so it's like, the guy's nothing. And so they came up, and they started shouting at him, and they're mocking him as he walked by. The interesting thing was he was already by. when they started. That's the other thing. How brave are they? They actually waited till he was by before they came out. And they started mocking him and taunting him, you know, and this go up, bald man, is like, yeah, you just keep on walking, you know.
Yeah, that's right, warriors. Just keep walking.
Yeah, just keep on walking. You don't want any parts of this, you know. Don't make me come over there. You just keep walking. And he's actually kind of, you know, up the hill when he hears them. And they're like, hey, just keep walking, Baldy. You don't want any parts of this. And Elijah turns around and curses them. And probably just keeps on walking. And they're like watching him go. And that's when they hear the growl behind them, you know. And the bears come out and kill them. But this you have to understand with spiritual warfare. The Baal prophets were mocking the prophet of God without even knowing it, right? And they were saying, yeah, you're nothing. We own this place now. This is us. But he's not nothing because the Spirit of the Lord was with him. And sometimes the prophets of Baal get really loud in our lives. Sometimes in our culture, in our area, there's a lot of them, those prophets of Baal. And you hear them. And they're like, yeah, you're nothing now. Have you heard that? Have you heard the Christian church is nothing now? You know, but when the Spirit of the Lord is with you, it's not nothing. And the power of the Lord is all you need. And the reason Elijah called fire from heaven wasn't because Elijah, it's because the Spirit of the Lord was with him. And so Elijah's like, you know, don't make me call my lions. You know, it's just like, just keeps walking on. Okay, so that's that. He was not killing poor little innocent children. I know that's kind of the way it gets depicted. They use this story in Sunday school to teach children not to make fun of bald men. And I know, you know, that's one use of it, but it's really not the appropriate use of it. I'm going to get back, though, to this cursed city thing. Because, man, what is the deal with assault? Of all the things, and this is something else that's very different. Elisha is a very different prophet than Elijah in that he uses props. Elijah never did. I mean, he sews up the heavens that doesn't rain for 3.5 years, but he does it off stage. We never see him do it. In fact, if James hadn't told us he did it, we would have never known. And so, you know, he just prays and things happens. Elisha uses things. Why? Well, I think part of it's their personality. And this is what's interesting. It was the same spirit in both men. But it manifests itself totally differently. Elijah and Elisha couldn't be more different. The only thing that was the same in them was the spirit. And that's true of us too. You know, as Paul says, the same spirit that raised Jesus from the grave is in us. But it's going to show itself differently in us because we're different. And God loves that. He loves the beautiful mosaic of our lives. He loves shining his light, you know, like so we become like a stained glass window, light shining through it, all these different colors. He wants you to be unique. People believe that I'm going to become a Christian, I'm going to become like everybody else. Not if God has anything to do with it, you're not. He wants you to stay the way you are. He wants to purify you. He wants to bring you out of sin. But he made your personality for a reason. And he gave you your talents for a reason. And he wants to shine his spirit through it and use it. And we see that in Elijah and Elisha. They're very different. And it acts very differently in them. But why salt? So he's different. Get that. But why salt? Well, let me just put it this way. It was cursed. And he removed the curse by sacrificing it. Now remember, originally, it was given to God as first fruits. When Jericho fell, it was given to God as first fruits. When they built this city up, they built it back up in sin. No one dedicated anything, sacrificed. None of that was done. It was a sinful act that brought that city back into existence. What Elisha is doing, I believe, is he's going back to law of sacrifice. And it shows up, by the way, there's this thing called the covenant of salt that shows up 3 times in the Bible. And 2 times, they're very, very similar. First in Leviticus, this is the instructions that were given to them when they would make sacrifices. For every grain offering of yours, you shall season it with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Okay, now, wise guys, I don't want to be cleaning salt out of our collection box, okay? Just so those of you who want to like mix salt with your check and put it in there, please don't, okay? But in those days, they would do that. Every sacrifice was seasoned with salt. In Numbers, it puts it this way. All the offerings of the holy gifts which the sons of Israel offered to the Lord, I have given you and your sons and your daughters with you as a perpetual allotment. It is an everlasting covenant of salt before the Lord and you and your descendants. Okay, so it was part of the sacrifice, but why salt? And this is, I mean, I've got to tell you something. I spent days reading on this. Because why salt? Of all the things, salt. Why did God say mix salt with your sacrifice? And if you didn't do it, your sacrifice was not accepted. I want you to know that. And so I believe what Elijah was saying with the city was, this was brought back to God but never offers as a sacrifice. I believe he was taking pure salt and throwing it in the water, saying, we're offering this back to you as a sacrifice. And when God accepted it, then the water became pure. Okay, so he did accept it. And that's grace on the part of God, because it was built in sin. But God's a graceful God. So what's the deal with salt? Why salt? And I read, and one theologian suggested that we have to understand that in those days, salt was as valuable as gold. I'm like, man, you need to read your history a little better than that. Because if salt was more valuable than gold, you should see how much salt's in the Dead Sea. You could take it, boil away the water, you'd be rich if that were true. You're talking about a people who could get salt. It was valuable, of course, as a commodity. They seasoned food with it. They preserved food with it. I understand salt had properties that were valuable, but that can't be it. I read a rabbi who suggested that the reason they did it with salt was because there was an Hebraic custom of the time, and an expression that has been discovered in those times that goes like this: I shared bread and salt with a man. That was like saying, I've broken bread with them, I can trust them, I've shared bread and salt. And that was a very common expression to say, I can trust them because we've shared bread and salt. And they're saying it's kind of a custom of the area, and that must have, been why. And I would accept that, except for the fact that the High King of Heaven does not follow local customs. He creates customs. So clearly God Almighty did not say, oh, that's what the Arabs are doing? Well, then that's what we'll be doing too. Plus the fact this predates the Arabs. So anyway, we're looking at this situation. I was like, I can't be right. And I kept reading and reading and reading, and nothing rang true until finally I left the Old Testament and came into the New Testament. I've said this before. I believe the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed, and the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. And I believe that the answer is finally given to us by Jesus Christ. The salt symbolizes us. I believe that what God is saying there is, you will put salt in with your sacrifice because part of you is coming with the sacrifice. Now, we know that our body has a lot of salt contest. If you talk about, this was really hard for me, you'll say it by blood, sweat, and tears. Ever taste tears or sweat? It's salty. We have salt. So, that's part of it, but I don't think that's enough of it. In Mark chapter 9, Jesus Christ says something that has really caused a lot of stir amongst the church for over 2,000 years. He says this: everyone will be seasoned with fire. Then he breaks and says this: salt is good, but the salt becomes unsalty. With what will you make it salty again? So have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. I believe that he's telling us, he's kind of bringing it back, because the fact he's talking about seasoning with fire, and I believe he's coming right back to the sacrifice, right? Now we know what fire does to things. That, it has a tendency to run out the imperfections and impurities. If you take gold, put it in fire, and they get that top of it off, that's just what they call dross, and what's left is pure gold. So we understand this is a concept that's used in the Bible throughout. Fire is brought to us to purify us. And you go through tribulations, and it purifies you. It takes out those elements of your character that aren't pure. And then he goes right from there to talking about salt, and I don't think that's a mistake, because the reality is that salt can't lose its saltiness, can it? We don't know how to do that. And certainly in those days, they didn't know how to do that. If you took salt and you took a big rock of salt and you pounded and pulverized it with a hammer and you tasted the powder, it would still be salty. You pick up all that, throw it in water, dissolve it, and boil the water away, what's left is something that tastes salty. Salt never loses its flavor. The component of salt can't lose its flavor. There's only one way that you can change something salty to not salty. Any of you guys watching the Food Network? That show Chopped is my family's new obsession. That's salty. What do? They start mixing stuff into it. If you got a meal that's too salty, what do? You either start over or you start mixing things in with it. And you start mixing counter things in with it, really. And you try to make it less salty and keep testing. They keep adding sugar and they add, kind of stuff on that Chop show, who knows what they'll add, maple syrup, who knows, and they keep testing it, and if you start mixing enough stuff in with the salt, it no longer has a salty flavor. Jesus is saying, look, You need to be purified with fire. Take everything impure out, and what's left is salt. If you lose your saltiness, you've mixed unholy with holy, then what's happened is you're no good. And some of you needs to be in every sacrifice. And this is the problem. A lot of us do offerings or sacrifices, Lord, but there's none of us in it. We kind of are like, you know, if you get a big steak and it's got some, you know, and I know some of you just eat steak, but I have to cut off the fat because I can't eat it anymore, unfortunately. And so like I trim away the fat and the gristle, you know, and I push that aside and I eat the steak. I love the steak. When I'm done with it, I don't care what I do with that gristle or the fat. Give it to the dogs, throw it away. I don't care. A lot of us approach God that way with what he's given us, right? We get time, we get talent, we get money, and we see how much of it we can use for ourselves, and we cut away the what's ever left over. I'll give something to God. There's none of you in that sacrifice to God. He's saying there has to be something of you in your sacrifice. If you want me to find it acceptable, there has to be some of you in your sacrifice, in your tithe, in your offering. If there's nothing in you, then it's not really there. We offer God gifts without salt. We do. We do it all the time. Now, I've mentioned there's three times in the Bible that God mentions the covenant of salt. And I love that because the Bible actually is going to let us triangulate on this concept of salt and the covenant of salt. What is that? The third one is very interesting because it's very different. It shows up in 2 Chronicles. He says this, "Do you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the rule over Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt?" Well, how in the world does God salt a covenant? Make a promise to David and throw salt on him? You know, do you think that's how it happens? No. Do you know how he salted the covenant with David? I think this is really cool. He put Jesus in it. Jesus comes from his line. So he said, I have a covenant of salt with David, and here's how you know. I put some of myself in it. I put Jesus in it. And that's how he salts the covenant. We need to bring things with us to the Lord, and we need to pour part of ourself in it. There has to be part of us in our sacrifice, in our offering, in our tithes. But also on a macro level, and that's kind of a personal level, but on a bigger level, Jesus also says we're the salt of the earth. He says, I made you to come into the earth. Right? And he says, you're the salt of the earth, but if you become tasteless, it's no good. And I love what he says here. If it becomes tasteless, you might as well be thrown under the foot of men and be trampled. Boy, that's scary. Because I got to tell you something, a lot of our salt is losing its saltiness today. The world has rejected us and says we're useless in society. And we have earned that by mixing stuff in with the salt God gave us. We cannot mix sin and holy because the salt will lose its flavor. So what God's saying is, I need you to bring this with you in your sacrifice to me, and I need you to take this with you into the world. That's the thing. Sacrifice to me, offerings to me, out to the world. That's the whole gospel in a nutshell. Come to me, purify, back out in the world, make a difference. We've got to stop mixing sin and holy. So here's what we do. When we approach the world, we do it by mixing in their cultures, their traditions with ours, and embracing their values and mixing it in with the church until we have no effect at all and we're useless. And then we come to God and we say, well, I'll give you what I have left over. The salt's gone from our lives. It's gone with it before the Lord, and it's gone with it before men. I believe that there are many of us, I know there are many of you praying for your families. And praying for this township, praying for this country. We will make a difference in these things when we bring salt to it. Right? So we need to bring salt to the Lord and say, Lord, I'm in it. I am in this sacrifice to you. I am in this gift offering to you. I'm in it. Use me. And then he will. He'll take you back out and he will make a difference in your family and in this township and in this country when you are salt. Or we will be trampled under the heels of men, which is exactly where we are today, and we've earned it. The solution is we need to start with the Lord and then go back out. We need to bring salt to the Lord. Would you all please pray with me?